me I'd woken him. He picked up the phone and growled in his 5 packs a day voice, "Yeah, hello?" Prompting me to cheerily say something along the lines of, "Listen, I just wanted to call you because, you know, we actually did live together for 12 years or so, and, you know, even though you and my mom got divorced, you never did anything specifically awful to me. I mean, not really at all, right? So I just wanted to say, you know, I'm not mad at you or anything, and I'm, you know, I'm sorry I never spoke to you for so many years until now. I may have even thrown in some version of, you were always good to us." Which, I mean, really, he kind of had been in his nonverbal fucking manicures who turned out to be whores and taking all of our mother's money sort of way. Hey, at least he'd been present, right? Even though that presence included not wearing pajama bottoms and farting incessantly. I don't actually recall the ensuing conversation much beyond this point, but ultimately I know I was glad I called him, because soon after we received word that he'd suddenly and quite unexpectedly passed away. Not surprisingly, it was a fairly goofy, rarely heard of type of death. Apparently, late one afternoon, while he was shuffling and wheezing his way through the lobby of the Beverly Hills Hotel, a man approached him smiling and holding out his hand, saying cheerily, "Hey, Harry, how the hell are you? Long time no see," and gave him a friendly punch in the arm. Later that night, Harry was rushed to the hospital. It seemed that a blood clot had formed in his recently punched arm, which then subsequently continued on to a place it didn't belong at all, leaving Harry very, very dead, and additionally leaving me very, very grateful that I dropped acid that night with Mike, inspiring me to talk however briefly to Harry before he'd passed on to that great shoe store in the sky. Anyway, having called Harry, I found myself working backwards through my mother's husband's, which left me to now call my actual and very own father, Eddie Fisher. Well, as luck would have it, by now the acid was peaking, and I found a person very like myself saying something like, "Hey, Dad, you know, whatever, I love you, and I'm sorry we never actually connected that much. And, you know, maybe one day you could, you know, maybe one day you'd like to come visit me here in New York sometime or whatever." Well, wouldn't you know it, 18 hours later, the doorbell rang, and there, having caught the first flight out from LAX to JFK, was my long-lost papa, a grin on his face and a knockoff Louis Vuitton bag in his hand. Well, what could I say? However unconvincingly, but, "Come on in! Welcome!" As it happened, I'd very recently begun living with Paul Simon at that point, but I was still spending time in my apartment, especially when Paul and I would break up, as we were periodically wont to do. But as a result of my acid-induced reach-out, I was no longer able to move back to my place when Paul and I broke up. Like other couples, we remained living together in hell. Eventually, as in after a year, my dad moved to an apartment around the corner from Paul, from which he soon began sneaking drugs to me. This was when, like most fathers and daughters, we started doing blow together. Our relationship started with me longing for him to visit, evolved into me being desperate for him to leave, and settled finally and comfortably into us being drug buddies. As I've been known to say, in my family, the apple doesn't fall down far from the tree. After our New York inbred incarnation had run its delightfully inappropriate course, he managed to relocate to San Francisco, remarrying yet again. Only this time his wife was neither a beauty nor a celebrity, but was a lovely, wealthy Asian woman named Betty Lynn. In addition to her wealth, Betty's charms included being very much a family person. So it was in large part due to her that I began to see my father more regularly. And not only me, but my brother and my two half-sisters from his marriage to Connie Stevens, Jolie and Tricia, enjoyed this resurgence in our no longer neglected relations. As if this weren't enough, Betty turned out to be an enormous Debbie Reynolds fan. So my very estranged parents occasionally found themselves at the mercy of one another's company. But for all of that, my father was this unbelievably charismatic person. I mean, you know those people that for some inexplicable reason are just a pleasure to be around? Well, maybe you don't, but I do, and my father was very much one of these endearing humans. Even after everything he both did and didn't do, I somehow couldn't help but enjoy spending time with him. My father wasn't successful with women because he'd been rich and famous, though that didn't hurt. People gravitated toward him because he enjoyed them. He had a way of making you feel special. Because when you stepped into his sphere, you were all but guaranteed a good time. And though you knew with every part of your being that time with him couldn't be scheduled or relied on, all that could somehow be forgotten within minutes of finding yourself in his company. And sure enough, there you were again, the chump that couldn't seem to resist his playful charisma. Not even after promising yourself that the next time you found yourself succumbing to his eternally boyish charm, his all but unbelievable con, you'd remember. You wouldn't be such an innocent putz. You wouldn't buy into anything. And you'd ultimately end up going through the withdrawals after, inevitably once again being denied access to that incredible way he had of making you feel not only special, but necessary, even essential, to him. And all of this was as true to him as it was to you while it was happening. You can't counterfeit feelings like that, can you? Again, I'm really asking. In my opinion, though, in the interim until you get back to me, the answer is absolutely and unequivocally no. I had workshopped my show Wishful Drinking at the Geffen Theater in Westwood, California for a number of months before moving it up to the Berkeley Rep Theater in 2008. This was where we settled in to further work on the thing with an eye to eventually taking it to Broadway. I've always loved San Francisco, and not just because it's a beautiful old city situated around a sparkling bay. Over the years, I've spent a lot of time there attending to all things intergalactic, and in addition to George and all the folks who work for Lucasfilm, I'd collected a small group of other friends, several possessing a sort of literate spiritual bent. And, as if all these enticements weren't enough, lo and behold, it would appear that my now newly widowed father, rest in peace, Betty Lynn, was in dire need of a mommy. And as I had been recently and tragically suspended from my mothering duties, I was free to parent anyone who might enjoy being parented by me in the otherwise awful extended interim. And who should turn out to long to be cuddled and mothered like the big, bad, overgrown baby boy he'd always been? You guessed it. Eddie. That's right. I became my father's mother. It turned out that the best way to have a loving, reliable familial bond with my dad was for me to give him everything I'd ever wanted from him. And so doing, corny as it sounds, I'd get everything I gave him back again. In spades, clubs, hearts, and diamonds. He needed me. Finally. Nothing and no one but me would do. Over the course of the time I was there, my father confided in me that there was something he wanted to do before his life was over. He didn't have a bucket list, as it turns out. What he did have was a bucket wish, and it took a few weeks for him to express just exactly what that wish was. And when you hear what it was, you might understand just why he was somewhat shy about sharing it with his eldest child. What my father wanted was access to the recess between a woman's legs. One last romp, a romp at his age being a fairly limited affair, but that did not concern him. He had devoted his entire life to getting laid, sacrificing everything to it, his career, his fortune, and basically any real lasting relationship with either friends or family. Now, I'm sure many men at the end of their lives entertain similar fantasies. The only difference here was that most of them would be too embarrassed to admit such an undignified longing in someone of such advanced years. But my father had no such compunctions. Though initially it wasn't me to whom he'd confided this final desire of his. It was to my friend Garrett, who traveled with me as one of the producers of my show. He called Garrett Cowboy, though in later years there were times he was convinced that Garrett was President Obama. After suffering several strokes as the years progressed, my father was showing increasing signs of dementia. Of course, his daily marijuana intake didn't help matters, but ultimately I don't think it was the pot that caused my father to confuse a 32-year-old white boy from Jackson Hole, Wyoming, for our president. But in his right mind or out of it, his passion for one last pass at pussy remained undiminished. So one night I was doing my show, and I made an announcement that if anyone knew any prostitutes, please leave a note with one of the ushers. Because as it turns out, it's not all that simple to get a prostitute. At least not in San Francisco in 2008. And unfortunately, I did not meet with much success. I'd searched Craigslist. I would have perused any list, Schindler's List, Franz List, nothing. I fantasized that even though my brother and father were far from close, Todd might be induced to take on this task. But that potential bonding experience did not come to pass. But my father had a very capable, kind nurse named Sarah, a Mongolian woman who devoted herself to his care in his declining years. After a while, my dad's care became more demanding, you might say. So Sarah hired a cute little girl who came to work wearing a little outfit consisting of a short little skirt and a little shirt that ended very close to where her little midriff began. A slutty cheerleader type of getup. It wasn't long before Sarah phoned to tell me that this new part-time nurse had expressed outrage, when my elderly parent attempted to put his arthritic hand between her legs. Or was it her tits? Whichever it was enough to bring us to a moment where this girl accused him of sexual harassment. Now, this was a man who not only couldn't do anything for himself anymore, he could barely move, but would also mistake a blonde 32-year-old white boy for Barack Obama. At that point, had he been able to understand what was going on, my dad would have seen it as something of an honor to be accused of sexual harassment. But I had to tell him that I had talked to the girl, which wasn't true, though Sarah had, and that she'd apparently said, "What does he think I am, a prostitute?" I don't think it was so much that he thought she was a hooker as he hoped she might act like one. Anyway, I've thought since then that this is one of the best ideas in the world for a movie. The quest to get your melted, stoned, puff daddy a hooker. Who do you give to the man who's about to lose everything? He couldn't even get a blowjob because he was past the point where anyone with a blowjob would consider hiring him. I had heard that once an older person, and especially an older infirm person, falls and breaks his hip, It's just a matter of time before he passes away. And not all that much time, the proverbial they say. So you can appreciate my concern when Sarah called one morning in mid-September to tell me that my father, who despite having been unable to walk for the past 5 or 6 years, due to a series of strokes and a beyond obsessive devotion to the daily smoking of marijuana, had somehow forgotten the non-negotiable fact of his irrevocable and enduring immobility, and on this particular sunny Berkeley morning, had risen to greet the day, and swinging his useless legs over the side of his bed, stood up for the nanosecond before falling and breaking his hip. And naturally, my Eddie, being so much more than some average, everyday, ordinary Eddie, didn't just break his hip. He broke it in the worst possible place. He broke it in the place that prevents someone of his age from spending more than another week or two on the planet. So now we all knew that it was only a matter of time before we'd lose him. Somehow, though, I expected that the time he had remaining would be somewhat longer, and because of that unreliable assumption, I wasn't with him the night that he suddenly up and expired. And though there's something ironically perfect that after a lifetime of enduring his absences, I wasn't present for his death, well, this somehow continues to haunt me. I don't mean that he haunts me. I just wish I'd been there. Oh, well, another missed opportunity with Eddie. Only this time, it emanated from my end. Was this my unconscious way of giving him a taste of his own ever-elusive, intoxicating medicine? Maybe. I'd like to think not, though. I prefer to think that I'm not that obvious. But, by the end, overseeing my father's care had ultimately fallen to me. And I'd come to be grateful for this fumble. I mean, please, we both knew I was under no obligation to arrange and oversee his care. Whatever I did for him was because I wanted to. Not as some kind of payback that, as my dear old doting dad, was his due. But he actually was there when I entered this world. The story goes that he watched me being born. And though he fainted from the offensive horror of it, he was really there at the beginning of our shared time on the planet, just as I wasn't at the end of it. And we both knew that I didn't owe him anything. But owing didn't have any place in this. I owed it to who we'd come to mean to each other in the 7+ years leading up to his death. And so, yes, I do regret that I wasn't there to hold his hand at the end. I regret I wasn't there to gaze at him with tender, anxious eyes. Go figure. Maybe I'm just quirky that way. But there's something else that factors its way into this missed death bedboat before it left the harbor. The thing is, I've helped people die. Not that they couldn't have done it without me, and Lord knows all too many people end up doing it alone. But I've kept my fair share of vigils at the bedsides of those with only a few moments or days or weeks to spare. I know many folk that might find this a fairly daunting proposition, but there's something in that final fatal situation that I understand completely. I know what's required inherently of me, and I know that I'll do everything to be equal to this considerable situation. Everyone understands their role. One stays until the other can't anymore. And the one who won't be able to stick around is much more important than the one who can. And I find relief in the understanding and acceptance of the unspoken urgency in this arrangement. I'll love them until they can't be loved anymore in this whatever you call it. What's the word? Dimension? Plane? Could it be as wishy-washy and new-agey as that? In any event, I have accompanied several of my friends to that place where they can't be escorted any longer. You know what I mean. You remain with a dying person, accompanying them as far as you can go, ultimately finding yourself standing still while they kept moving. Moving until that place where they stop, arriving at that terrible stillness that goes on way longer than any life someone might have led. You continue leading your life while they follow theirs into the ground, being in nothingness. You love them until they can't feel loved anymore. Then you keep on loving them, as if they were still there, as if there's been a reprieve at the last moment and fate has reversed itself. It all turned out to be a bad dream that you both had and now get to wake from. My friend Julian was the first. Julian needed a prom date to take him to the dance that he wouldn't return from, his last waltz. Julian was one of the earliest sufferers of the AIDS virus in New York. Born in Australia, he'd moved to Manhattan, where he eventually came to work for Paul Simon's business manager at the time, Ian Hoblin. When Paul and I split up for the last time, I moved back to Los Angeles, which is where Julian contacted me a short time later to see if he could stay with me before he continued on to Australia, where his family would then care for him. But what we didn't know, but probably should have, could have guessed at, was that the flight from New York to Los Angeles would take whatever vitality that Julian could lay claim to. So for him to now get on another, even longer flight to go somewhere else that was even farther away, well, that was just a thing that wasn't going to happen. Full stop. So a new plan had to be devised. And that plan included Julian staying with me for several weeks or more, until staying anywhere fell outside Julian's formerly considerable skill set. One night, Julian threw up what must have been about a pint of bright red blood into a bright, stark white bowl. In response to my 911 call, or rather shriek, four men arrived at my house, wearing what appeared to be spacesuits, from their fishbowl helmets to their Pillsbury Doughboy outfits, complete with inflated gloves and boots. And these four men drove Julian to a hospital over the hill, into the valley where he spent his remaining days in and out of consciousness, with his sister, a male nurse, and me by his side. Making that final transition from here to there, from the known to the unknown, from why to why not. But from wherever he was to wherever he was going, there I was, his friend and devotee, learning as I, or as he, went, so I could potentially use this daunting skill set at a later date. And as we watched, this extraordinary nurse called it. "It won't be long now. He's gone into reverse labor. He's starting to die." And die he did. Death had come to take him. But it wasn't entirely selfish. After death takes someone from you, it gives you something back. It makes smell sharper and the sun brighter and sex more urgent. It's as though you're living for two now. Their memory lives inside you, and you feed it. You live for them now that they can't anymore. So given the choice between Julian and the rest of us, death chose our friend, our loved one, over us. He took the bullet, and we were left standing there with our empty guns, watching a tiny cloud of smoke barely making its way out of the barrel. Michael was next. This is what I found myself thinking at his deathbed, located between his death chair and death end table. There he was on his last legs, last words, last laughs. It was Michael's turn to be the first to cross over the finish line. Would he be waiting patiently up ahead for our inevitable arrival? exhausted from running our own last lap? Would he be there to ease us into death as we'd eased him out of life? Michael's light was dimming, while the bright light of loss grew brighter and brighter in us, until we were blazing with the grief of losing him, yet unable to warm ourselves. But I could swear that I could see things more clearly once he'd passed. Clearly and completely different, at least for a while. No one leaves here having learned something from death's lesson. They leave you to finish the lesson for them, hand in their paper, and find out their grade. Over time, I found that my love transformed into longing, a slow turning, like winter to spring. And it was in the spring that I started to breathe a little easier. I noticed the flowers that were growing instead of ones that I'd placed on a grave. I looked at things and thought, he'd have loved to see this. A swarm of fireflies, sunset on a lake, a two-headed fish, the palest of blue eyes, Serena Williams' thighs. And I found myself looking two and three times, again and again, at these glories I was continuously stumbling across, looking once for myself and once for the one who had gone missing. Maybe it is a bit like having second sight, seeing things almost exactly the same way as he finally did, even though this time it might be out of necessity. But I tell myself at least I had them for as long as they lasted, whether it be a friend or my father. Having lived alongside them, I hope to one day hang out with them way out there in those freaky fields of death, catching them up at last on what they've missed, smoking the weed that grows on the ground above you both, above all of us eventually. They can show you the ropes until one day we can all swing from them. Together again, laughing in the heavenly breeze, having lived to the half-empty, half-fullest, having lived until all that's left to do is die. Would you forgive me for beating this fucking metaphor to death? Here's hoping. Had I had these experiences, these intimate brushes with certain friends' deaths, as a way to prepare to escort my dad to that last big club date in the sky? And if so, why hadn't I been given the opportunity to use my hard-won skill set? And if there is a reason, would knowing what it was really matter? At least I have his voice captured like a rare butterfly in the saved message section of my cell phone. Trapped, a digital prisoner, still leaving me messages from the good to great beyond. My love for my dad was always more like longing, and it retains that quality, only now it can never be relieved. But in the end, finally, it doesn't have to be, because before it was too late, he was mine at last. Edwin Jack Puff Daddy Fisher passed away on September 22, 2010. There hadn't been a note he couldn't hit, a girl he couldn't hit on, an audience he couldn't charm or bring to their feet cheering. He'd done everything, and whatever he'd done to excess. Emptied that glass, drank the last dregs of the best wines, brandy, champagne. He'd lavished his women with jewels. There was talk of a diamond and emerald necklace worth some impossible sum that he'd given to Elizabeth Taylor, who didn't just love but required gifts, and preferably, if not exclusively, jewels. I see the scene. Elizabeth is seated in front of her three-way mirror, so she can be seen full face and from either side. There are lights around the mirror. Glowing, they line the top, dropping off straight down both sides. She is framed in illumination. Her shining dark hair is held up off her pale neck with a few well-placed bobby pins as she gazes at her reflection, chin up. those extraordinarily colored eyes of hers sparkling with the curiosity of a guest. She holds a soft pink puff shimmering with the almost invisible glitter of powder, powder that hangs over her, a devoted, loyal cloud. We see Eddie appear, her interim spouse, the mate that would escort her from her first great love to her last. My father kept Elizabeth Taylor warm and entertained and bejeweled between Mike Todd and Richard Burton. The later loves that dotted the rest of the spectacle that was her life were inconsequential. There he is. See him? He appears over her shoulder, brandishing that black velvet box, holding it out to her, his eyes shy and hopeful. She puts one of her perfectly manicured hands to her throat. A diamond blazes from the third finger of her pale left hand. Her so-called violet eyes sparkling, she bites her bottom lip, her head tilting to one side, and says, "What have you done, you big silly man?" Eddie shrugs helplessly, placing the mysterious dark box into the swell of her tentatively outstretched hand. "Open it," he suggests warily. The thrilling proximity of treasure is implied. Her right hand, the one temporarily unadorned by jewels, stretches toward her almost unexpected, but always somehow deserved, prize. Eddie is important now. Opening the top of the box, and the bright flash of diamonds is revealed. Bright gems interspersed with deep green ones. The diamonds making the emeralds just that much darker. The emeralds making it that much easier for the diamonds to claim the light. Elizabeth's eyes study this offering, almost as if recognizing it from somewhere else. That place where all jewels begin making their smooth, uncluttered way straight to her. Jewels arriving in her hands, having found the shortcut to get to her. A shortcut forged by desire. In my father's case, perhaps a feeling that he didn't really deserve to lie by her side. That this time with her was only temporary. Soon the bubble would burst, the clock would strike midnight, the footmen would return to being mice, and her real mate would arrive to claim her. So there, in the charmed meantime, Eddie would keep the area around her littered with jewels, with furs, with any and all things a queen both requires and deserves. It is her due. Allowing him a glimpse of her beauty, this is the price paid to travel that distance beyond looking to touching. He hurries quickly, his pockets filled with offerings, to fill the suddenly empty place his now deceased best friend has left for him to occupy. Recognizing his duty to keep her warm and shining with jewels, until the arrival of the male who was actually fit to be her partner, her equal, her mate. A king for her highness. So Eddie takes the time, whatever time he's allotted. "Remember this moment," he tells himself as he drapes the jewels shadowing past in front of her face. Glowing with satisfaction at her glowing, he closes the circle of jewels around her proud neck, her consort, till King Richard arrives to claim her. Somewhere he must have known that she'd converted to Judaism not for him, but as a belated tribute to his predecessor, the majestic Michael Todd. And maybe that was all somehow as it should be. But whatever and whichever way it was, this was his time. My father's time to stand in the light with her, with Elizabeth. So still, and yet he could swear. They were dancing. In 1967, when William Manchester was about to publish his book, The Death of a President, the author balked at making certain changes that Jackie Kennedy requested. changes which actually altered the truth. She tried to stop its publication and counseled that such an action could make her look bad in the public eye. She famously retorted, "The only thing that could make me look bad would be if I ran off with Eddie Fisher," who, among other things, had a few years prior been publicly humiliated when Elizabeth Taylor left him for Richard Burton. Having waited the appropriately respectful month following my father's timely death, I hesitated only briefly before Googling him, the postmodern form of grieving electronically in the 21st century. PDDD, post-traumatic death disorder. I was surprised to discover that he'd only been dead, an awful word when actually applicable, a little more than a month. It seemed like he'd been gone so much longer, and really gone this time. This was final. There was no getting around that this time he was undeniably, permanently, and conspicuously out of reach. Except for all those cell phone messages he'd left me, now embedded like a rare insect in digital amber. Somehow I'd known it might come in handy to save them. I just didn't realize how soon. His voice. His voice had been his most characteristic feature. It was the gift he'd been born with that had, among other things, ultimately purchased his celebrity for him. And when you combine that gift with his charm and boyish good looks, a trifecta of appeal emerged, erotic and otherwise, that made him, for a short but intense period of time, irresistible to essentially any woman. Well, okay, perhaps not any woman, but he had had that reputation, certainly during the 50s and 60s, of being able to bed a hearty selection of some of the most beautiful women in the world, and doing this not only during his prime, but also theirs. Sure, he was still having sex with his and a few other men's share of very attractive women in the 70s and 80s, but their quality, if not their quantity, may have gone ever so slightly down a notch. Let's face it, his allure for the opposite sex had taken the standard beating that all of us endure over time, not only for the opposite sex, but the same sex and everything in between. My dad not only had to contend with his somewhat diminishing visual appeal, but in addition, he developed something of an awkward reputation over time when it came to women. Though many of them were still drawn to him as a result of the gravitational pull of his original attractions and abilities, perhaps more often now, though, a woman might be drawn to him so that she might have something in common with Elizabeth Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor, considered by oh so many to be one of the most beautiful women of her, their, all time, had married my father. It had been early on in my conspicuous existence that I'd developed a habit, some might even suggest a defensive one, of mocking my family's tendency to generate public scandal and its attendant absurd behavior. This mocking, though it originally began in what might laughingly be referred to as my private life, eventually spilled over into the much more public arena. Over time, I began to be known as someone who could be counted on to be amusing when presenting an award, giving a speech, or even hosting the odd event. These speeches quite frequently included references to my infamous family. And as it turned out, one of these events, an AIDS-related fundraiser in Los Angeles, chaired by my one-time stepmother Elizabeth, happened to be an event that I'd agreed to host. I'd spent quite a bit of my public life fielding questions about Elizabeth and how I felt about her now. Did I know her at all? Did I forgive her? And perhaps even more to the point, did my mother forgive her? For that matter, did anyone forgive my father? The truth was, I didn't really know Elizabeth at all. I think that I may have met her once at the Beverly Hills Hotel while she was still technically my stepmother, and then we crossed paths many years later in London when she was once again married to Richard Burton. This meeting had taken place because my childhood friend Gavin De Becker was in their employ in some security-related capacity. Needless to say, this reunion was more of the uneventful variety than our awkward overlap during my infancy, although it was not entirely devoid of discomfort. Following that, I don't recall our crossing paths in any significant way until this AIDS fundraiser. On the day of the event, a bouquet of flowers was delivered to me at my home. This beautiful and quite enormous arrangement turned out to be from Elizabeth, and it even included a personal note signed by Elizabeth, though it had quite clearly been dictated by her and sent to anyone and everyone connected to the imminent evening. It was nonetheless a very nice thank you note, which I quite heartlessly used as part of my speech that night. Yes, there I was at the podium, facing a sea of gleefully Western-clad homosexuals and friends of homosexuals. It was, inexplicably, a cowboy-themed evening. So, assuming the air of incredibly quiet dignity that was made possible by my not being decked out in cowboy gear, I strode up to the microphone and introduced myself to the cast of Oklahoma before launching into my sad familial tale. Today, a beautiful bouquet of flowers arrived at my doorstep, flowers that actually turned out to be from my one-time stepmother, Elizabeth Taylor. Upon seeing Ms. Taylor's signature at the bottom, I read the attendant card with some excitement. I knew that it was more than likely the long-awaited apology for having stolen my father from me all those years ago. And so, clutching the little blue card in my hand, I ran back to my bedroom, and closing the door, I sat on the edge of my bed near my phone, lest it become necessary for me to call my psychiatrist after having absorbed Elizabeth's emotional and contrite communication. So I carefully opened the little envelope and, my heart pounding excitedly, I began to read. "Dear Carrie," the note began, "thank you so much for your participation in tonight's important event and for joining me in this extraordinarily important fight against AIDS. Yours sincerely, Elizabeth." Okay. Perhaps the note hadn't directly addressed the long-ago theft of my dad, but I could read an apology between the lines if I wanted to. Well, as I hope you can imagine, my remarks caused the audience of gay cowboys and girls to cry and laugh. Many later observed that most everyone in the room fell apart laughing. Everyone, that is, except for Elizabeth. But then, that might in part have been because she wasn't there. It was mid-morning on the following day that Elizabeth's assistant Tim phoned to invite me to her house that Sunday for her annual Easter party. "There'll be an egg hunt and brunch and swimming for the kids," he informed me gaily. "Oh, so then I can bring my daughter?" I asked him. Billy was about to turn 6 at the time. "Of course," he replied. So the following Sunday, I found myself poolside at Elizabeth's ranch home, tucked humbly into a hillside littered with trees in the area of town many refer to as the Beverly Hills. I sat in a chair near the pool and watched Billy splash around with the assortment of other favored children in attendance. After about a half an hour or so, Elizabeth appeared in the open sliding glass doorway, wearing a colorful, age-defying dress, draping over her now ample, iconic form. looking every inch the aging movie star that she was, hair arranged perfectly and makeup just so. She paused, drawing any and all eyes watching, as she made her way to one of the chairs situated under the umbrella near the shallow end of the pool that Billy frolicked in. Naturally, her hairdresser, Jose, made his way confidently toward her, handing her a plate full of canapés, his cowboy hat poised atop the head that was known for the golden braid that made its way down to his ornate belt and belt buckle, though not all the way to his pale, animal-skinned cowboy boots. I stood at the pool's edge clad in my usual black attire, worn for the rumored magically flattering effect it had on the chubbier body. Though I was much thinner at this stage, I nonetheless imagined I was the portly person I eventually became. Sitting in the shade, drinking chilled glasses of what I assumed was iced tea, Elizabeth squinted through the sunshine, studying me. "I hear there's something we need to discuss," she ventured, tilting her head to one side. I shrugged and approached her, smiling sincerely. "Not really," I assured her, pushing my hair away from my eyes. "It's just... well, I heard at some point that you had said something not all that great about my mom at a dinner party recently, and I didn't think that was..." I searched almost my entire head for the right word, finally coming up with polite. As she blinked, looking past me toward the lawn opposite, I continued. "Someone told me you called my mother a goody two-shoes at this dinner party recently. And I just didn't think it was all that appropriate. I mean, among other things, it's not accurate, you know? I mean, whatever, there had been a point where she might have shied away from swearing, but for many years now she's been cursing like a sailor." Elizabeth frowned at this, gazing stonily at me. "I don't remember saying that," she said definitively, looking remarkably to me as though she actually did remember saying it. It also crossed my mildly ill-mannered mind that my former stepmommy maybe wasn't all that accustomed to being spoken to about the possible inappropriateness of her behavior. Not that what she'd said had been that big of a deal. I just thought, you know, whatever. Maybe it was time to revisit the nature of how Elizabeth viewed and/or discussed my mother in our ultimately not all that private of a life. Elizabeth rose, her head held high, and imperiously disappeared back into the house, only to reappear a short time later. She made her way back over to the pool, where I'd returned to watch Billy and/or avoid Elizabeth. "I'm going to push you in the pool," she informed me. Not in a threatening way, but more as if catching me up on the afternoon's upcoming events. I studied her. Was this a threat or a threat? "Do it," I challenged her, causing her to tilt her head to one side suspiciously, her eyes narrowed. "No, you'll just pull me in after you." I shook my head, removing my non-waterproof watch and setting it on a nearby glass table. We studied one another in the hot sun. "No, I won't," I assured her, in part because I'd recalled hearing she'd had her hip replaced a while back, and I wasn't anxious to rust any potential titanium implants she might now be sporting. With my watch now safely resting on the poolside table, I did my best to maintain my friendly, albeit respectfully challenging, expression. We continued holding each other's gaze for the briefest amount of time until finally she pushed me gleefully into her pool, causing warm water to spray high into the air, wetting any guests who might have had the anecdotal luck to be in range. Then, with both my knees bent, I pushed my bare feet off the bottom of the pool, catapulting me back up through the water's once smooth surface. And, catching the fastball of my breath, I drew whatever amount of the available sunlight into my lungs, and gasping, broke free and was finally able to begin the friendship with my former stepmother. Liz! I started laughing. I felt like an Olympic runner who breaks that white tape with her chest, with everyone cheering wildly from the sidelines. Meanwhile, there was Elizabeth, standing there, clapping her bejeweled hands. Somehow, this entire semi-eventish moment made perfect sense, you know? For whatever totally weird and insane reason, maybe everything in our tragically well-documented relationship had been leading up to this moment, like we'd sort of had this date from the beginning. Elizabeth was still standing at the edge of her pool watching me while I splashed around, no doubt incredibly relieved to have fulfilled our destiny. Our team, Elizabeth's and mine, had won whatever race or game it turned out we were playing. It was all over except for the sobbing. Elizabeth, who was now kneeling down, extending her arm to help me out of the pool and back into a world where we could now have a relationship that, though born out of the ultimate tabloid phenomenon, was so lifelike, it almost had a genuine quality of love. "Get her one of my robes," E.T. called out to Tim. "Either the violet or the yellow, whichever. Oh, and a towel." Tim nodded as he returned to the house to do her bidding, while I, having hauled my wet black ass out of the pool, now stood bent over beside Elizabeth, laughing and gasping for air. When I stood up, we slung our arms over each other's shoulders, laughing riotously, she largely dry and me soaked to the skin. By then, people had begun to gather around us, cheering. Around us, Elizabeth Taylor and me. Us. Soon after, a towel was magically produced and enclosed me in its white wings, while from stage left, a Coca-Cola materialized. Eventually, Tim returned with Elizabeth's yellow muumuu, which made me look like a tent with a head. Soon after, the ever-present hairdresser, Jose, stood poised to one side, his neat braid descending from beneath his cowboy hat and trailing ridiculously down his ass-kissing back, ready in case I needed a quick blowout. Ever since then, she loved me. Simple as that. This was how we neutralized anything that might otherwise have been toxic to our situation. A few months after that, she invited me and my mom to lunch. And to round out the table, two blondes and two brunettes wise, I brought Meg Ryan. So it was me, my mom, Meg, and Elizabeth. And Elizabeth was giving Meg some romantic advice because Meg was with Russell Crowe at the time. And for whatever reason, maybe the hard-drinking movie star with the British Empire accent aspect of him, Elizabeth equated Russell with Richard Burton. So we all went over to Elizabeth's, and it was, well, it was great. By then, she and my mom were getting along really well, using four-letter words and the like. We got together a lot after that. Then presenting her with awards became a regular thing with us. For one of them, I even thanked her for getting Eddie out of our house. Big joke, right? But it was when we filmed These Old Broads, a TV movie I wrote, that she finally actually did apologize for real to my mom. I mean, she sort of apologized before, but now she said, "I hope if there's any outstanding, you know, whatever, I..." And I saw my mom following Elizabeth out of the trailer that day with tears in her eyes. It was a really nice gesture on Elizabeth's part. I mean, you know, considering. And when Elizabeth discovered that my mother had become kind of a potty mouth, things became easier between them. They could be motherfucking friends again. A few years before Elizabeth died, we were on the phone and I asked her, "Did you love my father?" After the smallest of pauses, she said, "We kept Mike Todd alive." The last time I spoke to Elizabeth, she called to get my father's number because she was going to try to make amends with him or something. I guess you get to a certain age and, I don't know, if you're still alive, you want to contact people from your past. I realized recently that Elizabeth and Eddie were married for the same amount of time as my mom and Eddie. And that whole clusterfuck of choices completely ruined his career. Just slaughtered it. Well, that and the fact that he shot Speed for 13 years, another distinction for me. I mean, who else in my class could say, "Dad, show everyone your tracks"? The thing is, my parents weren't really people in the traditional sense. I think this was partly because they were stars before their peopleness had a chance to form itself, both making more money in the first year of their celebrity than either of their families had made in their entire lives. The studio essentially designed my mom. They taught her to talk, had her ears surgically pinned back, shaved her eyebrows, which never grew back, and changed her name. Made her into this celebrity someone, new and improved, a star. My dad's big break happened at 14, which was when he was discovered by Eddie Cantor while he was singing in the Catskills. Cantor put him on his radio show, which led to him getting a record contract with RCA. A few years later, he was drafted into the Army and served his country by entertaining the troops. There was no way my father was going to be caught with a gun in his hand, unless we're talking about a Wesson-styled euphemism. While he was in Germany, he saw my mother in Singing in the Rain, so when he was asked, "What's the first thing you want when you get back to America?" he said, "I want Debbie Reynolds." So, fast as a bullet to a bad guy, a publicist simply set it up. Arranged for them to meet at a Hollywood restaurant, and from that point, I mean really from the very first few minutes, people were watching them. On their fourth date, the publicist arranged for the two cute stars to go to Yankee Stadium. As they entered the stadium, 30,000 people stood and cheered. And that was it. The game was on. My mother was 22, my dad 26. She was known as a good girl, so he became her adorable other half. It took a lot of years for him to be known as this womanizing, drug-addled rake. It's hard to know if he ever really loved her. I do know that they both loved being adored by millions of people they'd never meet. Who wouldn't? I mean, except somebody secure and sane. They just happened to be treasured as a twosome. She was this really pretty, famous girl who everyone seemed to agree was adorably desirable. So you gotta figure that if everyone else wanted her, well, then he probably did too, right? Everyone just seemed to totally love the notion of my dad and my mom together. I mean, look at them. He had black hair, she had blonde hair, he could sing, she could dance, and they both had pearly white teeth. Not only pearly white, but also uber straight. And to top it all off, neither one was a hunchback, which put them way ahead of a small but significant portion of the population right there. Bottom line, the two of them looked like a perfect teensy couple that could be found perched optimistically on a wedding cake. They were good for show business, so what the hell? They just went with it. I honestly think they were just kind of swept along. I don't think they really had any idea who the other one was. What they did know was that they had a big impact on a lot of people when they were together. They were America's sweethearts. They embodied the American ideal. They belonged to the fans who had invested all this energy in their unbelievably cute coupleness.